like to call to order this special joint interim committee on public education appropriation. We have our Senate membership, Senator Hass, Senator Gerard, and myself, and Representative Buckley. Do you want to introduce the House members?
Certainly. We have the absent, currently, temporarily absent Representative Gelser and Representative Springer and myself, and we're happy to join you, Senator, on this committee.
Thank you very much. In case people don't know, we're here because of something the legislature did back in 2001 when they submitted ballot measure one. Ballot measure one was then approved by the voters. And basically, it says that every 2 years, we have to review K-12 funding, and we have to tell whether or not it's adequate. And we have to, if it's not, we have to tell why, and why we haven't properly funded it. This is an interesting exercise, and so that's what we're doing here today. This meeting is scheduled to go from 5 to 7. We hope it won't run that long. If we get done sooner, that would be fine. Representative Buckley and I have met with staff in preparation for this meeting. Dana is our committee administrator. Dana Richardson has done this before, so she knows more about what we're doing up here than all of us combined. And our committee assistant, Ian Tolson. Welcome, Ian. And Dana, the first thing I guess would be to approve, adopt our committee rules. That'd
Indeed.
Be correct. And so, Representative Buckley, do you have a motion?
Quickly, would you like to open an organizational meeting?
Oh, I can do that. Open an organizational meeting. Now, adopting the rules.
Mr. Chair, the rules are in front of us, and I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 30th, 2009.
These are boilerplate rules. Is there any discussion of the rules? Is there any objection to the adoption of the rules? Hearing none, they're adopted. Now, Dana, where are we?
I'm going to close that one and open an informational.
Close it. Open an informational hearing.
I'm Dana Richardson, and I'm going to just quickly go through some information outlining what we're doing here today, as Senator Monroe has already briefly explained. Sorry, I went a little too quickly. So we've got our statutory charge, and then I'll do a review of previous reports where you have a sense of what's come before. As Senator Monroe mentioned, that voters adopted ballot measure one in November 2000, and then in order to enact that constitutional requirement, which is in your packets, I think it's like the second or third page, it has the constitutional provision and then the statute, ORS 171-857, that was adopted in 2001. Generally, you all are required to issue a report on the quality goals for post-secondary education and the sufficiency of funding for K through 12. And I can, we'll start with post-secondary, I'm sorry, here, let me keep up with what I'm saying, here we go. The post-secondary education piece is generally a minor piece because our report must identify whether there are quality goals established by law for post-secondary public education. That's a bit of foreshadowing, I'll tell you that there aren't, but work is being done on that, and we'll hear about that later this evening. So the focus of the report, given that there aren't post-secondary goals in statute, generally is the K through 12 public education funding. And what our report needs to do is demonstrate that the amount appropriated by the legislature is the amount determined by the Quality Education Commission to meet quality goals. And you all receive the Quality Education Commission report beforehand, and those officials will come and tell us more about what those goals look like and how they reach those figures. Should it be the case that we did not appropriate enough monies to reach that figure, that we'll issue a report indicating that there is an insufficiency. So that report by statute would detail the extent and the impact of the insufficiency including the effect upon current practices and student performance, as well as best practices and student performance. Now, previous reports have followed that guideline, the finding of insufficiency, the extent, and the impact. There is, this committee does have open to it an alternative, and you can decide that the QEC report should not be used as the basis of the reporting requirements. And if that's so, the legislature must basically develop an alternative methodology that's based on research, data, and public values, as well as the performance of successful schools, professional judgment, or a combination of those factors. And you'll hear that that is partly how the QEC does its work, based on professional judgment. So, but you do have the option to develop an alternative methodology for issuing the report. Our deadline is 180 days from sine die, so this year that's the day after Christmas. And I'm just going to quickly go through previous reports so you have a sense of what those look like. The first one was issued for the 01-03 biennium that was chaired by Senator Deckert and Representative Morgan, and the finding was that the K-12 funding did not meet the figure put forward in the QAM, and that the post-secondary was exempt because there were not statutory goals already existing. So this is going to be a theme, because essentially every report has made these findings. But more specifically, that report, the recommended amount was $6.061 billion, and the appropriation was $5.202, which was later reduced due to the failure of ballot measure 28. And when Senator Monroe says, "I know more about this than some of you," I know that's not true, because a lot of you have been here and through, you know, kind of different options to try and provide more funding and the ways those have impacted the quality goals and K-12 education generally. So the extent and the impact of the failure to reach the recommended amount were, the reasons were identified as declining revenues and increased costs. And we'll see this as a theme across the reports as well. Declining revenues were attributed to things like the national economic decline, the failure about Measure 28, and a reduction in local property taxes. Increased costs were identified as the special education costs, PERS, insurance costs, and utilities costs for schools. The impact of the insufficiency was that most districts chose to use available reserve revenues, shorten the instructional year, or both. And with regard to the impact on student performance, it was found generally that test scores held steady, but there were declines in 8th grade writing, 5th, 8th, and 10th grade math. So the following biennium, this committee was chaired by Senator Burdick and Representative Morgan, and again, the finding was that the funding did not reach the recommended level and that post-secondary was exempt because they did not have quality goals in statute. The recommended amount was 6.995, and the appropriation was 5.2, which was later reduced. Now, on page 11 of the most recent report that's in your packets, there's a graph, and we kind of call it the gap graph that kind of demonstrates the difference between these numbers here over time, the recommended amount and the actual amount. So it's page 11 of the 07-09 report, which I think is probably at the bottom of your packets.
Is that in this report?
Nope, that's the QEM one. It's the one that's black and white on the front.
Bottom one. Okay. I got it.
So the reasons for insufficiency that were identified at that time were declining revenues, including falling state revenue, a national economic decline, ballot measure 5, the implementation of the equalization formula, and then increased costs, including federal mandates like No Child Left Behind, IDEA, PERS, and health care. The impacts that were identified were, for schools, a reduction in staff salary and benefit adjustments, and or a shortened school year. So folks, you know, kind of did the best they could with a combination of different options available to them to make up the shortfall. And with regard to the impact on student performance, the percentage of students meeting state standards was expected to stagnate or decline. In 2005-2007, this was chaired by Senator Devlin and Representative Flores. Again, the funding was insufficient and the post-secondary was exempt. The recommended amount was $7.035 billion and the appropriation itself was $5.24 this year. Fortunately, in the second year of the biennium, the funding actually increased to kind of narrow the gap for that given year. And the reasons for insufficiency cited were an adoption of ballot measures 5, 47, and 50, the economic recession, the failure of ballot measures 28 and 30, and then federal mandates, and still rising PERS, employer rates, and health care increased costs as well. And the impact of the insufficiency on student performance was that student performance was expected to stagnate. And then the most recent report, which you have before you, this was chaired by Representative Buckley and Senator Devlin, and again, the funding, we didn't get there, and the post-secondary wasn't specifically reported on because the statutes were no different than they had been before. The recommended appropriation was $7.66 billion, and the actual appropriation was $6.245 billion. The reasons for insufficiency should sound familiar. ballot measures 5, 47, and 50, failure ballot measures 28 and 30, federal mandates for special education and No Child Left Behind, and the impact of the insufficiency was determined to be that student performance may improve, but at a diminishing rate. And so, I know I totally breezed through all of that, but I think some of this is old hat for some of you as well.
Dana, wasn't it in 07 we sent back over $1 billion to taxpayers because of the kicker law?
That's a terrific question for LFO, but I think that's right.
Well, I know we sent back over $1 billion. I think it was in, I'm not sure it was in 07 or 08. And I wondered if that it would be appropriate to cite that as one of the reasons for insufficient funding.
I'm happy to make a note of that. Any other questions?
Questions for Dana? Mm-hmm. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is the numbers that you gave for the QEM that was required to the level that we want to bring it up to and that we're doing the comparison to. I was just kind of thumbing through that. How do you make that calculation?
We've gotten it from the Department of Ed. I'm sorry, which calculation? The gap?
Well, I was looking on page 3 of your little thing here. It says state funding requirement for baseline. It's kind of...
Of the report?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have total state funding requirement for fully implemented model down below. So I just was wondering where for the model to be implemented, how do you make those calculations?
And you're asking about the QEM calculations?
Right.
That's best addressed by the folks who do those calculations, and Brian Reeder's here from the Department of
Ed. Okay, great.
Anything else, Dana?
Nope.
Okay, questions for Dana? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to hear from the Legislative Council. Anna Lee. Welcome.
Hi. I am Hannah Lai. I'm Deputy Legislative Counsel. I was asked to come in and give a brief summary about a court case issued by the Oregon Supreme Court in January of this year that related to appropriations. The court case was brought by 18 school districts in this state, and what they sought from the courts was for the courts to declare that the Legislative Assembly did not appropriate a sufficient amount of monies for the 2005-2007 biennium, and also to then come back and require the Legislative Assembly to appropriate the sufficient amount of money. The court looked at Section 8, Article 8, which I believe you have in your packets, and looking at the first clause of that section, the court concluded that, yes, the Legislative Assembly is required to appropriate a sufficient amount of money for schools. Also, the court concluded that for 2005-2007, no, the Legislative Assembly did not appropriate a sufficient amount of money. But the court stopped at that point. And the reason the court did is because it was looking at the second clause of that section, which is the reporting requirement that allows the Legislative Assembly to issue a report that says basically why an insufficient amount was provided. Based on that, the court said, you know, there wasn't an intent to make the Legislative Assembly to come back and provide a sufficient amount of money. And so that's basically what the court concluded, is that we can make a declaration that a sufficient amount of money was provided to schools, but we will not require the Legislative Assembly to provide a sufficient amount of money. And so that was basically the end of their conversation.
Are there questions for him?
Questions?
Oh, boy.
It's very straightforward.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Monica?
While we're waiting for the presentation to come up, Monica Brown with the Legislative Fiscal Office. As at least three of you are keenly aware of what was appropriated for 09-11, since you actively participated in the Ways and Means Committee, I will try to keep comments very, very brief. You have a handout in your packet that has three slides. Basically, I want to cover what was appropriated, the trigger provision, and then respond to a question that Representative Buckley had asked earlier about federal dollars. The first being, just straightforward to the 2009-11, the state-funded level of budget is just over $6 billion for school funding. That would be from all funding sources going to the state school fund. That is below the essential budget level that was calculated by the School Revenue Forecast Committee by about just a little over $500 million lower than the essential budget level. When combined with the local revenue resources as part of the equalization formula, the total for 2009-11 is just under $9 billion, which is slightly lower than the $9 billion that was anticipated for 2007-09. To kind of give a reference point, I think most of you are aware of the declining revenues, or not necessarily declining, but inadequacy of revenues to support and balance the essential budget level for the state in general and lottery funds. By way of comparison, this $6 billion for the state school fund is about 8.3% below the essential budget level. Statewide general fund and lottery fund budgets were about 12.4% at the final adopted budget. So again, kind of a reference point for you there. In order to access the full $6 billion, most of you are probably aware that there is a $2 million allocation that is part of that that will occur in June 2010 if certain financial conditions are met. The sum of the following three state reserves or resources must exceed $100 million, and that is the projected general fund ending balance, and that would be based on the June forecast that is anticipated in 2010. The balance in the Oregon Rainy Day Fund and the balance in the Education Stability Fund at that time. So if those three combined balances are in excess of $100 million, then the trigger, if you will automatically kick in and would allocate that $200 million to school funding, or up to $200 million. The resources that would be available would be 100% of what's in the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, and then once that was fully exhausted, if that was did not meet the $200 million, then the next would be to go to the any unappropriated general fund resources that are available, up to a maximum of additional $200 million allocation. One question that folks might ask is, well, what about the Education Stability Fund? Because of the constitutional requirements around that stability fund, we could not pass, or the legislature could not pass during session, an automatic trigger of any additional dollars out of there. That would take subsequent legislative action if the resources in the Rainy Day Fund or unappropriated general fund were inadequate to meet that $200 million allocation. You would have to make an affirmative action in the next regular session to do anything additional. And then finally, I know that was really high level, but I think most of you are aware of where we are. Representative Buckley had a question about federal funds. One of the findings that you have stated in past reports were the Fed's not providing adequate resources either for Title I or IDEA or any of the other mandates, No Child Left Behind. We don't have an absolute costing within the state of what all of the federal requirements are. This chart gives you a general trend of within the grant and aid program, the federal dollars that are going out through Title I, IDEA, nutrition programs. So you can see a general upward trend. We still anecdotally believe that we're not covering, these dollars are not covering 100% of the federal requirements, but clearly they are increasing to the extent that that provides some help.
Senator Haas has a question.
Just real quick, does it include stimulus money, that last bar?
Yes, Senator Haas, this does include additional stimulus dollars through there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. In the federal fund issue and the federal mandate issue, many of the reports indicated that sufficiency was related to a lot of what I would call negative things that have happened in the history of Oregon, those ballot measures and special education. And that seems to kind of stick out because that's a population of students that, as they're framed in the report, appear to have happened to our state. And that as I read through the language, it talked about that money being diverted from general ed sources. As a member of the Revenue Committee, at the beginning of this last session, the presentation on special education, when he did a survey of the state of the districts in the state, found that not all school districts were using all of their double weight that went into their programs, that more than half of the school districts overall were not spending all of their special ed dollars on special ed. Do you have that data, and is there a way to reconcile the revenue office's data with what goes into the report in terms of the flow of funds?
Members of the committee, Representative Gelser, I don't have that with me today. We can certainly investigate that further as to how locals are utilizing them. Again, on a statewide basis, we would be passing these through largely formula-driven. The grant and aid, the feds pass it to the Department of Education. They pass it on out based on formula, whether it be Title I, certain requirements there, IDEA, going to have different requirements there. Obviously, within the school formula, the first chart that was up there, it's going out under the weighted formula, actual reporting of students and the reconciliation. So presumably they would be spending at least the state dollars consistent with the double weighting.
Could I follow up?
Sure.
In this grant and aid federal funds, those are only the dollars that we directly send through. Does that count the federal IDEA dollars that go directly to the local districts?
Members of the committee, Representative Gelser, these are the dollars that come to the state and we pass through. If there are dollars going to the locals and they do receive some directly, that is not included in this chart.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Additional questions? Monica, the previous slide, I think, that showed that we appropriated $6 billion in 2009-11, but $200 million of that is subject to the trigger. So in fact, if that is not triggered for whatever reason, that 6 million becomes 5.8. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Monroe.
Thank you. Additional questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Monica, on the trigger, can you give us kind of a snapshot of where we are after the August-September revenue forecast? Where we are with our balances.
Sure, we're just dandy, Representative.
Thank you. I'll accept that as the answer. Let's move on.
Representative Buckley, obviously, there are a couple more forecasts that you have to experience prior to meeting the June timeline. But with the last forecast, the calculations we went through and said if all things held consistent based on that forecast, there would be adequate dollars to allocate the $200 million. There would be sufficient funds available to do that.
Thank you,
very close, but sufficient.
We're keeping our fingers crossed. Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'm assuming that would require the legislature being sustained in terms of the revenues that were created.
Senator Monroe, yes, based on that last forecast, based on what it projected for the general fund ending balance, the anticipated rainy day fund, and the allocations to the stability fund, holding that forecast constant, if it were to hold through June 10, there would be adequate resources to make that $200,000 allocation or $200 million allocation.
Okay. But if the $750 million goes away, then clearly the $200 million trigger would not be met.
Senator Monroe, that would be dependent on the actions that the legislature would take in February. If the legislature came in and decided to balance with all cuts such that your ending balance and your reserves were maintained, so, you know.
Like I said.
I'm sure it was a rhetorical question, I'm sure, and I attempted to answer it anyway. So.
Okay. Additional questions? Okay. Are you finished?
Yep. That's it.
Thank you, Monica. Dana, who's next?
The Quality Education Commission.
Okay. Susan Massey and Brian Reeder. Quality Education Commission that keeps telling us how much money we need and we keep saying we don't have it. Ms. Massey, welcome. Identify yourself and proceed.
I am Susan Massey and I chair the Quality Education Commission. And you need to know that I care enough about doing this work that I drive 3 hours from my home each way. And I do have about 7 minutes worth of testimony to provide for you tonight. I am very passionate about schools and about school funding. And you need to know that right up front. I thought maybe I would present to you in terms of three questions today, and then hopefully give you some answers to those. The first is, what is the commission and what is its charge? The second is, what is the basis for the commission's report? And the third is, if the model shows us what works, how are we doing? So what is the commission? In 1997, the Legislative Council on the Oregon Quality Education Model was appointed by then Speaker of the House, Lynn Lundquist, and charged with developing the Oregon Quality Education Model. Its purpose was to identify the fundamental requirements and costs for a quality education designed to meet the high standards established in the law. And the law reads, a world-class education system with rigorous academic standards for all students and expectations that all children are challenged to meet their potential. Their first report was published in 1999. That would have been 10 years ago. The Quality Education Commission was established in statute in 2001, and the charge is three parts. Number one, determine the amount of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of K-12 public education meets the quality goals established in statute. Number two, identify best practices based on education research, data, professional judgment, and public values, and the cost of implementing those best practices in K-12 schools. And number three is to issue a report to the governor and legislative assembly in even numbered years that identifies current practices in the state system, the costs of continuing those practices, and expected student performance under those practices. Further, to identify best practices for meeting the quality goals, the costs of implementing those best practices and expected student performance under those best practices. And finally, to identify two alternatives for meeting the quality goals. That's our charge. So what's the basis for the commission's report? Model provides for those things which research, data, and professional judgment have proven to be effective. That's where those elements come from, the elements that are found in the prototype schools in the model. The model calculates a per student cost of these factors in three prototype school models, that is elementary, middle school, and high school. That information is used to project statewide costs of the model. We also know, based on research, that best practices occur when instructional programs are focused on individual student achievement of high standards, when there's a learning environment that fosters connections with students and with significant adults, when schools make data-based decisions about the effectiveness of programs, and when adequate professional development, cost-effective resource management, and innovative use of time to deal with student needs are provided. If these things are to be provided, it's obvious that we must have enough highly skilled, dedicated educators as well as adequate facilities. And that's where the cost comes in, of course. If the model shows us what works, how are we doing? I must report here that class sizes continue to rise, that course offerings have diminished, especially in subjects not tested on the state assessments. Dropout numbers are up and graduation rates are down. Student progress in reaching the benchmark standards has slowed in most grades. In the 2006 report, the Commission explored in some depth the relationship of funding to student performance. The model is about the cost of doing business, if you will. The difference between the need, as recommended by the quality education model, and the actual appropriation remains about constant. That difference over the last five biennia has shown a gap of $1.6 billion on average. To put that gap in perspective, I must also report that Oregon's K-12 spending as a percentage of personal income dropped below the national average beginning in 2001. And Oregon's per student spending is also below the national average. Please know that I'm not blaming you personally, and I don't hold you, each of you personally responsible, especially in these economic times, but this isn't a new problem. And unfortunately, the fact is that as a matter of policy, the state of Oregon continues to set the K-12 biennial state school budget with an arbitrary process, not based on what education actually costs, but on what the legislature determines it can afford. There's no other contract process of which I'm aware that allows us to sign on, then pay based on what we think we can afford. We have a contract with students of this state, and in my view, we all need to work together to find a better way to honor it. Thank you. If you have any questions or
other questions from Ms. Massey, Representative Gelser.
I just wanted to say how glad I am you were willing to make the drive.
Oh, thank you.
It was a very good presentation.
Thank you.
Additional? I'd like to personally thank you for your commitment to public education. I've been involved in education for 45 years, and we need more people like you, and perhaps we could do a better job of solving the problem that you've enunciated. Thank you. Mr. Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent with the Department of Education. I was also staff to the Quality Education Commission. I'll just be real brief and go through a bit of the mechanics of how this works. And I'll start off on page 3 of the 2008 report, and I hope in the process can answer Senator Girard's question about how these calculations are made. There's a table at the top of page 3 that sort of goes through the steps of calculating the what we call the funding gap. The first line there shows you what we call the baseline. The baseline is really a measure of how much we're currently spending for K-12 schools in Oregon, and this includes both school districts and ESDs, and this is the state share. It doesn't include local revenue. So we're in the neighborhood of, you'll see the 05-07, $5.3 billion roughly. The baseline also represents for a coming biennium what we call the essential budget level. So you'll see that in 09-11, the essential budget level was just shy of $6.6 billion. At the concept of an essential budget level is what will it cost in the coming biennium to provide the same level of services that you're providing in the current biennium. So in other words, in 09-11, it takes $6.6 billion in state money to provide the same level of educational services as $6.244 provided in 07-09. The reason those numbers tend to grow over time is we have student enrollment growth in Oregon, rather robust, and we also have inflation. The price of just about everything goes up over time. So that's why those numbers grow. The third line down there shows what the Quality Education Commission, through the use of the model, projects the cost to be of fully implementing the model. In other words, providing a level of educational services that the commission believes will meet the educational goals that are in statute. And so the way that process works is the commission spends a lot of time looking at best practices. They do that really in three ways. They look at academic research in the education field to understand what's working. They talk to educators in Oregon, and they also do some field work. And this last round of the commission spent a lot of time interviewing school principals, teachers, even students about what is needed in Oregon schools, and identified some very successful Oregon schools and focused on those that were in a lot of ways beating the odds, schools that had high levels of low-income students, high levels of ESL students, high levels of special ed students, and yet were achieving very high levels of student achievement. So they looked at, they did that field work to try and better understand what's working in actual Oregon schools. Based on what they learn from those three exercises, they go back to the model and they say, what types of resources, what kind of people, how many of them, what kind of supplies, computers, all those sort of inputs to the education process do we need to bring about the results that we desire? And that's the basis of that third row down there. And the 09-11 number is $8.347 billion, which is about $1.7 billion above the EBL. So that's what we identified at the time as the funding gap, how much we think is required relative to what we think we're going to have. Well, it turns out we have a lot less in 09-11 than the EBL because of the revenue situation. So to this $1.7 billion gap, we need to add another $600 million because instead of having $6.6 billion in state money, we only have $6.0 billion. So we're at a gap of about $2.3 billion given the situation we're in right now.
Or if we don't trigger the other $200 million, it'd be another $200 million on top of that.
That's correct.
Or $2.5 billion shortfall.
That's correct.
Thank you. Go ahead.
That's all I have.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Reeder?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Buckley.
Yeah, just to point out, that is, this will give us the largest gap since the QEM has been in place. It appears, am I correct, on this to be the largest gap of any QEM?
Yeah, I think if you turn to page 25 of this report, see a history of the gap. And you'll notice that in 07-09, prior to the sort of bottom falling out of the revenue picture, we actually made some fairly impressive progress in closing the gap from $1.8 billion in 05-07 down to $1.5 billion in 07-09. But the revenue picture has changed that dramatically. This $1.75 billion in 09-11, as I mentioned, is really closer to 2.3 at this point.
Additional comments? Questions? Senator Haas.
While this gap is somewhat depressing, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that if you judge just by, you know, general scores and student performance, there has been progress, gaps notwithstanding.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. I think it's a testament to Oregon schools that they've continued to make progress in student performance despite the size of the gap. As Susan mentioned, however, part of that, I believe, has been achieved by, in some sense, narrowing our focus. We have fewer electives in many of our schools because we're focusing on those core subjects now. That, in some people's minds, is not a bad thing. In other people's minds, it is a bad thing. So, but it, we are observing that.
May I also add to that?
Go ahead.
Thank you. I believe that it's obvious that able students do well. You really don't have to do a lot to facilitate good learning with able students. But the problems we're having are with those students that are struggling. We find ourselves also under the mandates of No Child Left Behind, and we see our schools being declared below standard often. But it's the time and extra attention that we need to be giving to those students that are struggling that will really make a difference. And frankly, we just don't have enough resources to do a lot of that kind of work now.
Senator Monroe, I agree with both of you, and I just didn't want this to be 100% downer.
100% negative, yes. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, but, you know, there are some things that we don't test, such as physical education, where districts have dropped physical education, and we all know that the impact of that and other things in our society has led to an epidemic in childhood obesity. So there's some things that that schools used to do or used to help with that they're not doing anymore, and many of those things are not tested. Anything else for the witnesses? Thank you both. Appreciate your commitment and your continued service to the state.
Thank you.
Okay.
The governor's office.
The governor's office, Margie Lowe. Welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, for the members of the committee. My name is Margie Lowe. I'm an education policy advisor for the governor, and I'm here this evening to share with you an update on the progress being made by the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission. This is a group that was appointed by executive order by the governor in 2007, and the group's charge is to develop a parallel model for post-secondary education, similar to what we have for the primary and secondary education processes in the quality education model. Post-secondary education is a very different type of delivery system. We don't have in the university system local revenues as a contribution, but for both community colleges and the university system, we have tuition, and that is a growing proportion of what's been funding our post-secondary delivery system in Oregon. This week is an unprecedented week in post-secondary education in Oregon. The numbers of students that we have on campuses all across the state is way exceeding, I think, just about anybody's expectations back when the governor signed this executive order. The executive order uses as a framework for this work the goals of 40-40-20. That is that we want all Oregonians to finish high school with a diploma. We want 40% of Oregonians to have achieved some sort of post-secondary credential, be it a certificate for a program or an associate's degree, and another 40% of Oregonians to have achieved a bachelor's degree and beyond. We consider that to be very important for not just the individuals, but for the vitality of our state and its economy and its citizenry. And that's been the focus for how what we call the PSQEC has approached its work. The chairs of the committee, Mary Spieldy, who is the president of Lane Community College, and Ed Ray, the president of the Oregon State University, are not able to be here this evening, so I'm their designated spokesperson. But I guess it's okay because I get the privilege of being the person who works most directly with the
the model that we have under development, and that's very exciting work. So I'm glad I get a chance to be here to share that with you this evening. The PSQEC met on Monday of this week, and for the first time we were able to share with them parallel information to what the Quality Education Commission has related to the cost of achieving the 40% target for bachelor's degrees in Oregon by the year 2025, as well as the beginning work related to the associate's degree level. What we've not yet developed a solid methodology for, and we're still working with a higher education consulting group in Boulder, Colorado, is on the certificate side of this challenge. Certificate programs in Oregon vary widely. Some of them are 6 months in duration. Some of them are 2 years in duration. Many of them are in what we call professional technical programs, which require additional investments for laboratories and work settings that are above and beyond costs that other than a normal classroom type of setting, which is much less expensive to maintain. So we're working on developing a more accurate methodology for that one key component, as well as trying to measure all of the various contributors in Oregon who help create that credential, because although community colleges are a substantial contributor in this area, we also have a fair amount of it coming from the private sector, both private institutions and employers. So we want to make sure that we capture that and don't unnecessarily add to the projection for something that is already a vital part of our economy. So in addition to that, the model building, we are also going to be using that model because it has as its basis the current cost of the post-secondary system, the public side of the post-secondary system in Oregon. So we're going to go in and we're going to evaluate for the various levers, and those levers include the college-going rate of students coming out of high school or the college-going rate of various segments of the adult population, what their costs would be. In addition to that, student retention figures, particularly for freshmen, and then the percentage of students who actually attain the credentials and degrees. So we're going to be using the cost figures that we have related to each one of those to try to develop a method that helps us determine the cost effectiveness of each dollar spent in each of those categories, to then build a set of recommendations for the 2011 legislature to help guide our recommendations to you for where we ought to make the best investments in post-secondary education in Oregon. And that's exciting work. And it's good to be able to inform that, not just with national research about best practices, but about real cost information that we have coming out of our own system. In addition to working on the best practices side of this, we also are going to be working on a 5-year plan, which would help identify key actions that the legislature should consider near-term and midterm on our way to getting to the 2025 goal. We need to be very deliberate if we hope to achieve that destination in a reasonable amount of time. And we need to plan for what the impact would be in good times and bad times. I mean, right now, although it's a very stressful time in our economy, it's also a time where a lot of people are choosing to invest more in their own future potential. And we need to have a process that respects that opportunity that normal economic cycles are going to produce as a way of helping us get to that destination. We also would like to find ways in which, as the economy improves, that we have mechanisms that would encourage these individuals, because many of them are adults that will go back into the workforce as the economy improves, that they stay with their programs so that they get all the way to the credential that they were hoping to get as they made decisions to go to school this fall or last spring. So we're looking for ways in which we not just set the hook, but actually reel them in terms of getting that final product.
The group will be making a report to the governor in September of 2010, and these are the types of things that we expect to have included in the report, and after that, I'm sure we'd be glad to engage in a lot more discourse with all of you about our recommendations. Be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But just to clarify, so the plan is to come to the 2011 legislature with a series of proposals. Will those proposals make up a model similar to the QAM, or are these simply proposals that are steps on the way there?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it will be a model that will help inform those recommendations on how we get to that goal of 40-40-20 by the year 2025. And so in parallel to the QEM process for K-12, there will be investments that are made over time. And, you know, the model gives just nice linear regression, smooth lines, but we all know that life usually isn't a smooth line, and that there will be some things that will be more easily achieved than others. And some of that is that we think we have a high number of working adults in Oregon who are very close to having finished credentials. But because we don't have a process that easily facilitates the completion of that, you know, in community colleges, for example, a student has to file an application for review of whether or not they've earned the certificate or diploma. And they have to pay a fee for that. Well, our university system doesn't require them to have that credential for them to transfer into the system. So it's an added cost, and there really doesn't seem to be any direct benefit to the student. So they never do that piece of paperwork that's going to cost them some money. But we probably have a large number of students who either have done that or are very close to having it finished. And so one of the suggestions that's a bit in the national press right now is to change how we structure our reimbursement system so that we're looking at incentivizing our institutions to for completion. And that if the institutions knew that it was important to us that Oregonians actually achieve those credentials and that that was part of how their compensation were structured, that they'd probably do more things to help students make sure they got across that finish line. And so those are some of the suggestions that the commission has got as consideration. We'll probably be doing some research with a variety of institutions trying to figure out, because when we look at the statistics, 33% of Oregonians who are between the ages of 25 and 49 indicate that they have some college but no degree. We don't know if that's a single course or if that's being only one course away from having attained that degree. We need to do some further study to find out what that distance is that still needs to be completed. And I'm sure we have a lot of community colleges who'd be glad to entice those students to come back and finish up the course and the paperwork and actually to have something to market their new skills back into the marketplace.
I follow?
Go ahead.
Just a quick, in terms of our work here, do you anticipate 2 years from now when a joint committee such as this meets, will we be at the point where we will have a requirement to address post-secondary funding as well as K-12 funding as part of the Measure 1 process?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a decision that still lays ahead of us. Right now, the work of the PSQEC is done via executive order. And in order for you to have a requirement, as I understand, it would need to be in statute that that be a charge to the state. And, you know, I think there are many people who think that that would be an appropriate mechanism, but the commission itself has not yet developed that recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions? Ms. Lowe, post-secondary is something I care a lot about and done some study of it. We have three elements in this state. We have quality private institutions that provide an education for tens of thousands of Oregonians every year, do an excellent job. many of them also have programs that assist those that have some education and life experience with what we call adult degree completion programs that have greatly increased the number of college graduates in the state. But we also have, of course, the community college system, outstanding community colleges, and the university system. It strikes me, though, that the two public elements, the community college system and the university system, are under different governances. And as a result, sometimes there isn't the level of cooperation or coordination in this bifurcated governance system that we have. I wondered if one of the things you're going to be looking at in terms of your recommendations is perhaps adjustments or reforms or changes in the governance system. It always struck me as interesting that community colleges and governance are under the same governance as K-12, but that the universities are under a separate governance, whereas the community colleges and the universities are both involved in post-secondary and work best when they cooperate with each other and have programs of transition from one to the other. Can you comment?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you make some excellent points. The most important thing from our view in the governor's office is that the entire continuum work very closely together, all the way from our pre-kindergarten programs through our graduate school programs, be they public and private. And we have invested a tremendous amount of time under Governor Kulongowski's administration in convening work groups and been very product and outcome focused about what we need to do in order to have the systems work in a much more seamless fashion. It doesn't really matter to the student who the institution is. Sometimes we get kind of caught up in animal warfare around here, but, you know, beyond that, I mean, the students are really interested in attaining the degree, and they're looking for the path that's going to be the smoothest and most time effective for them in which to get to that destination. And, you know, we've really spent a lot of time, and we've had really a lot of wonderful cooperation from all of the institutions, be they high schools, community colleges, the university system, and independent colleges, to really work at credit recognition, early learning support. You know, we have 2+2 programs that connect high schools to community colleges or to our university system. We've got programs that articulate smoothly dual degree, dual registration programs that exist between community colleges and public and private universities or colleges, four-year colleges. So I think we've made a lot of progress. Are we done? Absolutely not. There are still many things that we can do. And I, you know, just in the meeting I had at noon today with the various heads of Oregon's education agencies, there was agreement that one of the key areas that we can look for a lot of gain in the, particularly the certificate part of our goal, is in looking at how we reinvent high schools. So that's really a matter of how we stitch together not the work of just the PSQEC, but the K-12 QEC along with the post-secondary QEC. That's where we're going to get, you know, it'll be efficiencies for the taxpayers, but it'll be a tremendous boost for the students. And that's really who we need to make sure we're serving well.
Well, I've seen, and there are examples in the state of wonderful cooperation between, for example, a community college and a university. I'd just like to see that be universal across the state, not just there's a good example here and there's a good example there. I mean, I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from a Oregon University, and I also have a master's degree from a private college, and I'm currently serving on a community college board. So I'm kind of been involved in the whole thing, and I'm very fascinated. I'll be looking forward to your work if I'm back here for that session. I'll be looking forward to your recommendations. I hope they will be thoughtful and meaningful recommendations, and that you'll not be afraid to kind of think outside the envelope a little bit when necessary.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm hoping that most of you are aware of the work that the governor's trying to engage in during this interim. He's appointed
a variety of officials to what he's calling the reset cabinet. And one of the key areas that we're looking at is the entire education enterprise. And we've got two different groups, one looking at K-12, another looking at post-secondary, but there is regular interaction between the members of both of those groups because there is so much interdependence.
Thank you. Are there additional questions from Ms. Lowell? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Okay, now we come to, we're going to close the informational meeting. We're going to open a public hearing, and we have some invited testimony. And first on the list looks like Lori Wimmer. Welcome.
Good evening, members of the committee. Lori Wimmer, for your record, from the Oregon Education Association. Happy to be here. Thank you for waiting this late in the evening. I know you've all had very long days this week. On behalf of our, I think, still 48,000 members thereabouts, it's my pleasure to submit testimony, as we have each year that the legislatures before you have engaged in the development of the report as required by Article 8, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. Our association has been interested in this from the beginning for several reasons. One is, of course, that it is our top legislative priority, adequacy of school funding. Secondly, our members worked to pass ballot measure 1 in 2000 and collected signatures to put it on the ballot, and so they feel that this is their baby. And thirdly, we were supportive of the lawsuit for the 18 plaintiff school districts against the state of Oregon that you heard detailed earlier this evening with respect to the adequacy question. Finally, we know that the link between the state's legislative achievement goals and the amount of money it costs to get there is an important data link to continually keep our eye on, and we think that the transparency of that process is very important for the public. For that reason, we encourage you to continue in the path of your predecessors as you develop this report. They relied on the sound research of the quality education model and the commission, of which we've also been participants over the years. We believe that because it is a nationally regarded model, because of the way it goes about doing the costing method, and this isn't just the QEM telling you how much you should appropriate. It is the QEM telling you how much your own education standards cost to achieve. And I think that's a really important distinction, because if your ambitions are here and your dollars are here, the public gets confused about those expectations not matching up to the dollars and the performance not appearing to be what we tend to overpromise and underdeliver. And that's a problem for all of us. Last biennium's report was able to report that the 2007 legislature had made great strides in closing that gap that you heard about between the actual funding level and the recommended level, and sadly, the trajectory has ceased its upward climb, as we all know too well. I did do, and you'll see in my written testimony, a little back-of-the-napkin math on what those percentages are. Whereas we were roughly 80% of QEM with that 07-09 appropriation before the cuts, which, by the way, weren't on that last slide. It's not 6.245 anymore. It got about $103 million, if I remember correctly, taken out of it between December and February. But so I worked off of the final number, just so we're clear on that. But we are now in a worst-case scenario of the challenge to the fair tax plan, as low as 69% of the QEM instead of 80. It would be 71.8% if those extra $200 million are, in fact, allocated in the second year of the biennium. But so that's a very breathtaking step backwards, and I'm sorry to be the bearer of those bad tidings, but I do want to also say that being a glass half full kind of girl, I would like to remind you of the 2008 November election cycle and all the ballot measures that were on that would have blown an even bigger hole in the general fund lottery budget for 09-11. Mm-hmm. And it could have been so much grimmer than it was in terms of total resources available, and your job would have been even more impossible than it was, but for the hard work of all the folks who helped us talk to the citizens about what those measures really did so that they defeated them all. So we're grateful for that not happening, and we're also grateful for the priority that you did make education as you put together this impossible budget and the balanced approach you took in making sure that you did the very best you could with the circumstances of the economic collapse of the entire planet that landed on our doorstep as well. We know that it's also true that to invest in public education is to invest in Oregon's economy, and we don't mean that just as a human investment for the long term, I'm fond of saying. We mean it as an immediate economic return on the dollar, because you're keeping those dollars home and investing in public education. Those dollars cycle into the economy. We've provided for you all a couple times over our economic research from Eco Northwest and from Dr. Richard Sims that shows that you create 9 jobs in the private sector for every job in the public sector, and that there are all these dollar returns in terms of the employees in those communities. More than 50% of the communities in Oregon, the school district is the largest employer. And so to help the students achieve our state's ambitions for them and reach their capacity is also about keeping Oregon healthy and a standard of life that we all would want for everyone. One final note. It is possible for you not to use the quality education model as your yardstick, but we have often argued against it, and we continue to point out that the kinds of measures that some have argued ought to be there, SAT scores, those kinds of things, do not measure what it is you're trying to measure, which is our ability to bring our students to standards and to the ambitions of our education laws. And they don't measure that. That's not what they were designed to measure. That's not what they do measure. And so those data, while maybe interesting, do not tell you what it costs to provide the kind of education you envision for the students of Oregon. So we would ask you to stay with the QEM, which you've invested greatly in as well over the years, in 10 years. I know it's been an enormous sum of money, probably nearly, what would that be, $75,000 a year, wasn't it about, I think? I can't even remember anymore, but too many numbers ago. But there have been many years of investment of state resources in developing and fine-tuning this nationally regarded model, so we think it's important to use it. And it also then helps you, from biennium to biennium, keep your comparisons, apples-to-apples comparisons as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, should you have any. Otherwise, if you want to go home, I'm happy to just leave, too.
Any questions for Lori?
Thank you.
Any questions?
All right.
Thank you very much for sticking around.
Yes.
Dana?
Chair Monroe and Buckley. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy director with Stand for Children. And I, too, am probably not going to tell you anything that you don't already know. But one thing I just wanted to highlight, if it hasn't come out enough yet, is that the Quality Education Commission does a couple of critical things. First, of course, it determines how much it would cost to fund what we consider the schools in Oregon that would meet the academic goals we've set forth for our kids. And obviously, this is incredibly useful, and we've found year after year we're incredibly behind that figure, and that's one of the reasons Stand for Children members advocate for increased school funding. It's why we're advocating the Lottery Commission to lower returns to retailers right now and increase returns to the state. So we'll advocate for a yes vote on the January referenda, and it's why we'll come back to you in February and hopefully work hand-in-hand with you to make some changes to our kicker system so we can also address some of the stability issues related to education. At the same time, the other thing that the Quality Education Commission does that is so critically important for Oregon to continue to do, and I don't think gets quite enough attention, is that it captures, analyzes, and publishes some of the best practices of Oregon's most successful schools at a given, you know, inadequate and unstable budget level, which I think is just a critical opportunity that we need to capitalize on more, is to learn what the most successful schools in Oregon are doing with inadequate and unstable funding, and see where there are opportunities to apply those best practices in schools that are less successful with the same amount of dollars. I was just looking back before this hearing at the most recent, I think it's the most recent report, the Best Practices Panel composite report, where they basically interviewed principals and teachers and held focus groups of schools that were defined as successful in Oregon. These schools had high student test scores in math and reading. They had been rated exceptional in the Oregon report card. They'd had an improved percentage of students meeting or exceeding benchmark in one of the categories of students that don't tend to meet or exceed benchmark at the level we want, so students that are economically disadvantaged, students from minority communities, students that are learning English as a second language or third language, and schools that were finalists in the Superintendent's Closing the Achievement Gap Celebrating Student Success Award, brought those schools together and basically said, what are you doing? And in addition to funding, two things that come up as hugely important for the critical, for the success of schools are leadership and effective use of time. And so I don't think we should lose that learning as we move forward and analyze the budget side of this equation. So I think that's it.
Other questions? Representative Gelser.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talked about the effective use of time, are you referencing full year school? Are you referencing extended school days? Are you referencing in high school block schedules versus periods?
Yeah, that's a great question. Representative Gelser, members of the committee, chairs. It really depends on the school, and that's one of the things that's really interesting when we start looking at best practices in education, is what works best for that school is what the teachers and principals in that school are incredibly committed to implementing. So in some communities, that looks like extending their school day a little bit, giving teachers a little bit more planning time during that day, but rejiggering it so that the kids can stay in the building for longer. In some schools, it looks like partnering with the community to offer after-school or summer programs. I know I was just in front of the Senate Education Committee talking with them about a program in Salem-Keizer where they offer summer school to students. They also use this professional development time for their teachers. So teachers get to come in and watch the greatest teachers teach during the summer, learn from them while they're also hitting, you know, the neediest students with some extra learning time. So it does vary community to community, but what a great opportunity to, you know, get together and say, hey, it looks like we have some similar challenges. You had this great summer program. We want to learn from that. Maybe the summer program won't work for us, but maybe doing it in after-school time would.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Has Stanford Children taken a position on full-day kindergarten and whether or not the state should be paying one full FTE for those students that are in full-day programs?
Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, Stanford Children hasn't taken a position on whether the legislature should change the formula allocation. We did take a position in support of Senator Hass's kindergarten bill last session, and we have been recruiting kindergarten teachers, parents, et cetera, to sit on the Oregon Department of Education's work group to look at that issue. And so we'll be actively involved in that conversation and hopefully be taking a position in support of legislation that helps Oregon move toward full-day kindergarten soon.
And I know that Stanford Children has taken position on teacher mentoring, principal
Absolutely.
Mentoring programs, because they lead to more efficient delivery of services Right. for the dollars, and I appreciate you doing that. I think organizations like Stanford Children that are citizen organizations that don't have necessarily a vested interest. You know, a lot of people are skeptical of employee groups advocating for certain things. I'm not, but some people are. But when you have citizen organizations like Stanford Children out there lobbying for better schools and for the things that it takes to to have better schools. I think that's a very positive thing for the state of Oregon.
Co-Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, thanks so much. I'm sure many would accuse us of having vested interests as well, but we try to stay focused on what really matters most, for sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your coming. For the record, we invited representatives from OSEA, from COSA, from Northwest Center for Educational Options, from Chalkboard, and they're not here. So we heard from those that came. The staff are going to work between now and our next meeting on drafting a report based on the information we received today and in consultation with Representative Buckley and myself. And that will be presented and approved, modified, or dealt with at our next meeting, which is scheduled for November 17th to 19th for one of those legislative days in the
three-day meeting.
No, it won't be a three-day meeting. Sometime in the November 17th to 19th. Is there anything else to come before this committee?
Senator Monroe?
Senator Hass.
I'm intrigued by your notion of wanting to explain the kicker. It was last biennium, but had it been put directed into a rainy day fund instead of rebated, there would, you know, that gap would be smaller and or there wouldn't be these tax measures and all. You know, things would look very different if there was an extra $1 billion available for education this
by anything else?
Right.
Any other? No. Anybody else? Any other pontifications or speeches or comments? Thank you very much. Appreciate working with all of you. Representative Buckley, anything?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
This meeting's adjourned.